This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We often hear about what climate change is doing to birds and trees, but you might wonder, how does it affect me? For one thing, it's making us sick. David Corot is a professor of biological sciences at Western Michigan University and researches the effects of climate change. He says climate change causes more deaths, makes it hard to breathe, and might even make us fat. Corot spoke with WMUK's Rebecca Thiel.
A lot of people think climate change isn't really going to affect them. It seems so far in the future. But there are things happening right now, right?
For sure. There are certainly human health consequences globally. World Health Organization estimates that each year right now, climate change causes about 300,000 deaths that would not otherwise have happened. Most of them are not in our country. Most of them actually are in Africa and parts of Asia. And there are a number of ways by which climate change does that besides just heat stress. It does result in more intense, stronger hurricanes. We've seen that very recently. And it results also in, because of the flooding that occurs after a hurricane or for other reasons, increases in waterborne diseases, so things like cholera. And there are also diseases that are carried by mosquitoes, right? They're insect-vectored diseases. And malaria is certainly increasing, again, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. But it is starting to get more common in Central America. So is another mosquito vector disease, dengue fever. And dengue fever actually now has crossed the border into Texas. The mosquitoes that transmit those diseases will move north as climate changes. And the more Earth warms, the more we allow it to warm, the farther north they're going to move. Mosquitoes that transmit malaria and dengue probably will not get to Michigan by the end of this century. But we have other, maybe less serious, vectored diseases, most notably Lyme disease. And the tick that spreads Lyme disease is moving north. Also, arthropods in general reproduce faster. They develop faster and reproduce faster if it's warm. The tick vector is already having, and certainly in the future, will have more generations per year. So populations of the vector will build up. So it'll move north and it'll get much more common. As a consequence, Lyme disease is likely to become even more of an issue in the Great Lakes region than it is today.
One of the first things that we think about when we talk about climate change, of course, is the heat. How is this going to affect our health?
It depends on what future we choose to have. So if we continue towards the future that we're currently headed towards, we can call it the business as usual future, then without question, there will be more very hot days and more times when a number of those days are strung together into what we call a heat wave. And heat waves are almost certain to become both more frequent and more intense, but probably most importantly, longer. And the reason that the length, the duration of a heat wave matters is that it takes a few days for excessive heat to start to cause mortality, to start to kill people. Typically, what we see is that the longer a heat wave goes on, not only the more deaths occur, but that increase is exponential. So if a heat wave average duration changes from 5 days to 8 days, it may triple the mortality associated with it. Now, there aren't any predictions for Kalamazoo. There aren't predictions for Michigan, but there are actually some predictions about heat waves in major metropolitan areas nearby. And a typical prediction is that if we continue along our current path, that is, we slowly, very slowly, shift away from fossil fuels towards cleaner energy sources, wind and solar, for instance, if we continue to do that at the slow rate we're currently doing it at, then by the last several decades of this century, 2070 to 2100, Chicago would have about almost 3 heat waves per summer, equivalent to the one that struck Chicago in 1995 and killed almost 750 people. If we instead decided, well, we're going to be more active about switching away from fossil fuels. The number of lives that would be saved, hard to predict because we don't know, for instance, how widely available air conditioning will be towards the end of the century. But it's shifting over to a pathway that gets us to only warming 2 degrees instead of 4.5, which, by the way, is the Paris Agreement goal. So if we honored our Paris Agreement commitments and the entire world did, that could save somewhere in the range of 1,600 lives per year in Detroit alone, somewhere in the range of 1,900 lives per year in Chicago. So there is a lot at stake just from heat stress.
You know, obviously we are seeing these latest tropical storms and hurricanes. Can you talk a little bit about how climate change affects these extreme weather events?
Sure. Climate change involves heating of the oceans as well. And in fact, of all of the heat that our greenhouse gases have trapped, the anthropogenic, the human-emitted greenhouse gases have trapped in Earth's climate system over the last 150 years, 90% of that extra heat has been absorbed by the oceans. And the ocean heat is the engine that fuels tropical storms, hurricanes. So it's a very easy conclusion to reach that warmer oceans will result in, for sure, more powerful hurricanes. It doesn't necessarily mean that there will be more of them, but the feeding of energy into that hurricane system is much greater if the ocean's warmer. So what do we get? More Category 4 and 5 hurricanes. I don't know if you saw the image from NASA's Earth Observatory recently. There were 3 hurricanes going on simultaneously in the Gulf and Southern Atlantic. I've never seen that before. I don't know if it's not ever happened, but I've never seen something like that. And of course, Irma was enormous, the second largest hurricane on record, with the second highest sustained winds. So global warming, the warming of the ocean, almost without question, will lead to stronger hurricanes, possibly more, but certainly stronger. Another interesting event that happened that caused a tremendous disruption in Houston in particular was the flooding that occurred after Harvey or as part of Harvey. And that occurred because Harvey stalled. It became stationary. And so the rain kept coming down in the same place. And that place happened to be Houston and thereabouts. And so there were record rainfalls and record flooding. It turns out that there is pretty good evidence that that sort of behavior by a hurricane, which is very unusual, is actually tied to one of the other signs of global warming, of climate change, which is the melting of the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. Because the Arctic Ocean is covered by ice for less of the year, there's more opportunity for heat to escape out of the Arctic Ocean into the atmosphere, and that changes air circulation patterns and in particular pushes the jet stream east and to some extent south. And that jet stream then can prevent a hurricane from continuing northward from the Gulf. So it creates an atmospheric circulation pattern that is one at least plausible explanation for the fact that Harvey stalled and we got this tremendous deluge affecting the Houston area.
So obviously here in Michigan, we don't get hurricanes. You know, what could we maybe experience?
There aren't a lot of predictions about extreme events in Michigan, extreme precipitation events. I think what we can very easily conclude is that at least over the next 30 or 40 years, we're likely to have more very heavy lake effect snow events. And the reason is that the Great Lakes are also covered by ice less of the year than they were. Once the lakes freeze over, you don't get water evaporating from the lakes into the air that they can then get deposited as snow when the air mass comes over western Michigan. So if the ice is not covering the lake as much, and in fact, in the last 40 years, the ice cover is 71% less than it used to be. So the lakes are open and evaporating water into the air much more for much more time than they used to be. And that's that evaporation is the stuff that makes the lake effect snow. So I think we can expect more intense lake effect snow for a while. When the air warms enough that the water no longer freezes into snow, then we'll get more lake effect precipitation, rain events, instead of snow events. There is some reason to believe that climate change will result in more frequent tornadoes in the Midwest region, but the models have a hard time predicting with any confidence their occurrence and intensity. But we have had an uptick in Midwest tornadoes in the last decade, for sure.
Now, you mentioned flooding or extreme rain events that can lead to foodborne and waterborne illness. You know, how does that happen? What would happen to us?
The problem with an extreme precipitation event is that the water comes out of the sky too fast to soak into the ground, and we get flooding. Flooding, if it is quite intense, can swamp our water treatment facilities, and so we can lose the capacity for a day or 3 days or 5 days to remove waste, biological waste, from our water system. So essentially what happens is untreated waste enters our waterways.
So like a sewer overflow.
Exactly. That can cause, for sure, E. coli outbreaks. And we know that beaches and lakes are sometimes closed because of E. coli warnings. It wasn't too long ago that Woods Lake in Kalamazoo was closed for most of a summer because of excessive E. coli. There are other consequences of that sort of flood, including erosion. So it's terrible for farmers, right? It takes away topsoil. It also brings a big burst of nutrients into wherever the water ends up, which in our area would basically be Lake Michigan. And that, together with the warming of the water, can lead to an increase in what we call toxic algal blooms, harmful algal blooms.
Which we saw in Lake Erie.
Exactly. We saw it in Lake Erie, and we have seen it in Lake Michigan, not as widespread as Lake Erie, but these harmful algal blooms, which kill fish and can be dangerous to humans if humans go in that water at that time.
Now let's talk air quality. When the earth warms, sometimes you get a lot of what we call ground level ozone. What does that do?
Air quality, as far as humans are concerned, certainly Michigan citizens are concerned, is primarily a consequence of two things. One is ground level ozone, like you mentioned, and I'll talk about that in a second. The other is very small particles. They're referred to as PM 2.5, particulate matter smaller than 2.5 microns. These are just little teeny particles that we can inhale. If they're in the air, we'll inhale them. They're small enough to get across our lungs into our bloodstream, and then they can go anywhere in our body, and they can cause all kinds of problems for various organ systems, but mostly for the heart and the lungs. So PM 2.5 is actually the worst thing that comes out of the smokestack of a coal-fired power plant. We here in Kalamazoo are in the plume from the J.H. Campbell power plant in West Olive, Michigan. It's up on the shore of Lake Michigan. We're about 60 miles away, I think, but that's close enough to be exposed to some particulate matter coming out of their smokestacks. And as a consequence, it is likely that some proportion of heart attacks, other kinds of cardiovascular issues, respiratory issues, including asthma, some portion of those events, those health events that happen in Kalamazoo, are a consequence of Michigan deciding that it's okay to burn coal to get our electricity. 2 of the 10 deadliest coal-fired power plants are in Michigan. The one that causes the most deaths per year is the Monroe plant outside of Detroit, and it causes about 280 deaths per year.
And we can trace it to that plant specifically.
Yeah. I mean, what you look at is the rates of death due to respiratory and cardiovascular issues, downwind versus upwind, of that plant. in populations that otherwise are similar, demographically, age, economic status, and so on. And the EPA and the Clean Air Task Force independently came up with that estimate, and they both came up with almost identical estimates. Also for the J.H. Campbell, to which 140 deaths per year are attributed, so about half as many as the Monroe power plant. All of the coal-fired power plants in Michigan together cause about 700 deaths per year. And many more heart attacks than deaths. Some of the deaths are from heart attacks, but many of the heart attacks are not lethal, and many more hospitalizations than heart attacks. The ozone is the other issue that you mentioned, and ozone causes fewer deaths, many fewer than the particulate matter, but it is certainly an issue, especially for people that have any kind of respiratory condition, including asthma. And ozone requires three things to be formed at ground level. Ground level ozone is bad ozone. Ozone up in the stratosphere is good ozone. Okay, that protects us from UV. But ground level ozone, if we breathe it, it is so reactive that it essentially burns our lungs. Because we are choosing to generate electricity by coal, we are increasing ground level ozone in southern Michigan, wherever there is a coal-fired power plant. The number of deaths that climate-induced increases in ozone accounts for in Michigan is probably in the order of 50 a year or less. So not as big a problem as particulate matter, the small particles, but still a substantial problem. Quite honestly, the most worrying scenario, I think, for climate change impacts on health of Michigan citizens is likely to be something that would occur outside of our national borders. Climate change is the number one or one of the two top threats to U.S. national security. It threatens the health of our citizens. By virtue of making serious conflict more likely outside of our borders, and the most common scenario that's most commonly discussed is an altercation between India and Pakistan. The irrigation for Pakistan's agricultural fields, the water for that irrigation, 85% of it comes off of the Himalayan glaciers, and it runs through the Indus River, which passes through northern India before it gets to Pakistan. As those glaciers shrink, the amount of water flowing through the Indus River will decrease, and at some point, very likely, will be small enough volume of water that India needs it all for themselves. And if India says, "I'm sorry, Pakistan, we cannot let any water flow through to you," Pakistan cannot exist. And if the existence of a country is threatened, and that country has, unfortunately, nuclear weapons, but so does the other antagonist, India. We have two countries that do not get along today. Both are nuclear powers. That sort of exchange, a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, for instance, would have more drastic short- and long-term health consequences for Michigan citizens than any direct effect of climate change on Michigan. We're likely to have conflicts that aren't motivated by greed. I want your resources. I have enough already, but I want more. I think that the shift will be to, I initiate this conflict because unless I get those resources, I can't survive. Within the United States, it's unlikely that we will run out of resources. We will have a much harder time feeding our own country. The breadbasket of the U.S. is one of the places that is predicted to dry out quite a bit. 2012, we had a big drought that centered at that time on the Midwest, and we lost almost 50% of our agricultural yield. And that sort of drought is predicted to become routine in the future. Even so, it's likely that we will figure out some way to produce enough food to feed ourselves. And almost certainly to do that, it's going to require very heavy irrigation of Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa and so on. These are not Great Lakes states, but they are within viewing distance of 20% of the Earth's fresh water. I don't know about you, but I think of it as more or less Michigan's and Wisconsin's and the states that border on the Great Lakes. I feel like that's sort of our water. But there will, in the not too distant future, I'm sure, be a discussion about whether that is state's resource or a national resource. If there is going to be internal conflict in our country, my guess is that it will be not a water war, but a water struggle.
Thinking about food more generally, you know, that breadbasket does supply most of the kinds of foods that we eat now. We could be perhaps eating more berries or other things that Michigan grows here. But, you know, for the most part, we eat corn and soy and wheat. And, you know, that's right. All pretty much grown in that Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, Iowa area.
That's right. And one of the other issues that is rarely talked about, I think it's unfortunate, it's actually been something I've addressed a lot in my own research, is that when we put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, plants get bigger. And they do. They grow larger, many of them, not all. But what really determines how valuable that food is for us is the protein. And what happens when they're grown under elevated CO2 is that plants like wheat get bigger. They do make more seeds, but the seeds have a lot less protein. And so if people think, well, at least farther north, some of our agricultural fields are likely to produce more just by virtue of there being more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the answer is yes, more, but of lower quality. And in the end, the feeding capacity per acre doesn't increase.
Perhaps one could draw the conclusion that maybe you would have to eat more in order to get the same nutrients. So
exactly.
In a way, climate change might be making us fat.
Yeah, maybe. We'd be taking in more calories per unit protein. And in fact, in some of my work, I grow plants under elevated CO2 and then feed them to insect herbivores. And the very clear pattern is that they eat about 50% more of the plant.
I read a really brilliant article the other day that said the reason that we're not talking about climate change very much is because we're scared. We're afraid of all of the things that we just talked about. You know, how do we get past that fear?
I think there are a number of reasons why people don't talk about climate change. Featured among them is the fact that it's just very, very scary. And I think the way to get past the potentially debilitating effect, I think, is to recognize that we have choices. The future is not set. And even better, one very good choice has been detailed and publicized and put out for approval, and that's the Paris Agreement. Now, the Paris Agreement doesn't make the future the same as today, but it makes the future so much better than the one that we are heading towards. And I think of students at Western today. I don't want our students to be retiring into a world that is full of civil and international conflict, where things that we take for granted today, the availability of food, the availability of water, where those are questions, where those are no longer guarantees. That actually is a component of health effects of climate change that is not talked about as much as I think it should be, and that's the mental health impact. You alluded to the fears that people have today. Absolutely, those are real, and they're justified, but the way to counteract a fear is to say, I can change the future. I can take that fear away. We still have that opportunity, and people need to get active in making the choices that will send us towards a livable future. And we need to do it pretty quickly. So I wish that Western students were much more engaged in this issue. It will be the defining issue of their lives. Climate change and all of the consequences that it creates. And we need a very active young people's voice in the process of making the critical decisions right now.
You know, there's only so much time in the day. Where do I put my energy? Do I put my energy into contacting my congressman, or do I put my energy into buying solar panels for my house?
Of course, my opinion is all of the above, and I understand that days are busy. The most important things that people can do, number one, is vote. Whenever the opportunity arises, vote, and don't just vote, be a climate voter. If young people in our country saw how much their future is at stake here and decided to put the decisions into the hands of people who cared more about the future, that is, registered to vote and actually voted and used climate as a hot-button issue for voting, we would get progressive legislation much, much more quickly. Young people younger than 30 know the most about climate change of any demographic group, and they vote the least. So politicians don't pay attention to people who don't vote. So number one thing you can do is pledge to register if you aren't already and then vote every opportunity you get. And in my opinion, have a candidate's position on climate change be the top, if not, or one of the top issues by which you make a decision. Second thing that people can do is make their own lives more carbon efficient. Everything from turning off lights when you leave a room to, of course, changing the bulbs that you use. LEDs are best, CFLs are fine. If you are paying your electricity bill, consider paying a little more in order to support green electricity. Arcadia Power is one. There are options both through other organizations and also through consumers, whereby you can state your support for shifting to smarter, healthier, greener energy sources.
I think those are green energy certificates.
Exactly. Right. You can get green energy blocks. There are a number of ways you can do it, and it costs a cent or two more per kilowatt hour, but I think of that as an investment in the future. A huge thing that people can do is decide not to eat beef. Beef is an incredibly carbon-intensive meat, second only to lamb. Chicken has about one quarter the carbon footprint of beef. So instead of having a hamburger, have a chicken sandwich, whatever.
Turkey burger.
Turkey burger is great. Have a veggie burger, even better. When people buy a car, the next time they buy a car, buy one that is at least 10 miles per gallon more fuel efficient than what they have. Energy Star appliances, insulating a house. If somebody listening is a homeowner, the most important single behavior you can show for reducing personal carbon footprint is weatherizing your home, which of course pays for itself fairly quickly. But I think the most important thing is to put the decision making in the hands of people that are going to make the right decisions. So I think writing to representatives, people who are making decisions on our behalf today, is great. It's a wonderful thing to do. Some of my friends and colleagues in the climate change working group here on campus say the routine should be get out of bed, have your coffee, write your representative, just a short email, go take a shower. You know, and that's how you start your day. So if everybody did that, it would be fantastic.
David Corot, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Corot teaches biological sciences at Western Michigan University and researches the effects of climate change. He spoke with WMUK's Rebecca Thiel. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.